And they start with maybe the easiest one of all, which is, what's your name?
Seema Agnani.
And what do you do, Seema?
I'm the executive director of Chaya Community Development Corporation. This is our 10-year anniversary, and we were established primarily to address the housing needs of the South Asian community, and have grown into sort of still primarily South Asian, but a multi-ethnic organization serving primarily the Queens community. And 95% of the people we work with are immigrants as well.
And how did Chaya come about?
Well, basically, a few of us who were involved with an organization called Asian Americans for Equality, which is a CDC in Chinatown, started to see the lack of such an organization in the city that worked with the South Asian community, and sort of the need to inform. The initial effort was really aimed at informing the community about their rights as tenants, educating them about the home ownership process, and ensuring that, these neighborhoods remain stable. There's a lot of displacement going on in the community because of harassment issues, eviction issues. The landlords in these neighborhoods, because gentrification is occurring in this neighborhood and a lot of Queens communities, there was a real need for that type of work. So we brought together community leaders and also brought in experts from the universities to talk about the demographic shifts, what the actual housing issues were, and from that initial convening, we sort of slowly formed the organization. So it was incubated within AFI in the beginning, and then we became an independent organization in 2005.
And why housing and home ownership specifically as a way to address the broader issue of neighborhood stability?
Well, when we did a needs assessment, so we surveyed, we talked to about 600 people in the community around the city, and we found that predatory lending was an issue, and this was in 2000. And we also found that most people didn't have a lease. We found that 50% of people we talked to didn't have a lease. And so that was pretty striking. And when we asked whether they were in rent-regulated buildings, they had no idea what rent regulation even was. So that makes it not only an issue of tenant rights, but it's about, as each tenant gets evicted, the rents go up, so it's an issue of preserving affordable housing. The more turnover there is in each unit, the more, the higher the rents go. So that in itself is an issue of neighborhood stabilization. And the housing courts, we saw that a lot of tenants were living in basements, and there really isn't too much you can do for a tenant who's living in a basement because they don't have rights beyond the basic heat and hot water. And so there's no right to stay in the apartment. If the owner wants the tenant out, they can evict them. And so that also, we saw families, their kids would be in the local schools, they would have been living in the neighborhood for like 10 years, and then all of a sudden had to pick up and move, and often ended up in another basement apartment because there's no affordable housing. So it was really disruptive to the individual family and to the community.
So, yeah, I mean, you mentioned basements. Are there sources of affordable housing hiding in plain sight?
Yes, well, we feel like basement apartments are a legitimate source of affordable housing. The issue is that they need to be brought up to code. They're often not safe. And so you hear about a lot of fires that are occurring around the city, and that's because the units have been renovated incorrectly. Often means of egress are blocked. People aren't able to get out if there's a fire. I think these units are the only source of affordable housing in some neighborhoods. And so there's a real need to make sure that they're brought up to code so that the tenants also have rights and the owners, it's in their best interest as well, in terms of being able to collect rents and ensure the protection of their own property,
How did you determine that this particular potential source of affordable housing was a priority area for your organization?
It became a priority pretty quickly because both owners and tenants were coming to us. When we started doing the general outreach, the majority of tenants who came to us were living in illegal units. And a lot of owners were coming to us because they were frustrated because tenants weren't paying rent. And so we quickly realized that the housing work that Chaya was going to do was not going to be the same as a group in Chinatown or in parts of Brooklyn where there are rent-regulated units. The borough of Queens is pretty mixed in terms of housing stock. There's a lot of single, two-family homes. There are co-ops. You know, that's another issue, is a lot of tenants of co-ops. That's a whole other area that we need to really build up our capacity in terms of being able to enforce their rights. And so because of that, we started to look at the issue. And then last year we actually did some documentation of how many units exist. So we've been doing advocacy with the city around the issue and say, look, you need to address this issue. And most elected officials avoided touching the issue for a very long time because, it's an issue of neighborhood preservation, right? So a lot of the older residents feel that new immigrants are coming in and ruining their communities. And so a lot of the elected officials are afraid to touch the issue at all. Meanwhile, the city is draining all sorts of resources. I mean, this issue is taking up time in the court system. The judges are all frustrated with it because these cases come to them and there's nothing they can do about it. The buildings department is tired of having to issue these fines. And I mean, they're making a lot of money off of the fines. But you talk to any of the inspectors and it's not enjoyable work for them either, you know. So it's also a huge drain on public resources when, you know, if we addressed it and planned for it, it could really be a resource for the city.
So stepping back for one second before I get back to that, the Chaya's work then provides direct services when people walk into your doors looking for what?
Well, we provide tenant rights assistance, so counseling. We'll go into buildings and organize tenants and help them advocate for their rights as a group.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll file HP actions and sue landlords who are neglectful.
What's an HP action?
An HP action is a group action by a group of tenants against the landlord, basically, usually to advocate for repairs or illegal rent hikes. So that's the name of the type of case.
Mm-hmm.
On the homeownership side, we provide education and counseling. You know, we're a HUD-certified agency, so that means we get HUD stamp of approval on our counseling, and if people go through our workshops, they're eligible for all sorts of down payment assistance programs and things like that. And then in terms of the basement apartments, what we try to do is often we mediate between owners and tenants. So we encourage the owners to not necessarily go through the court system because it's very costly for them as well, and we know what the result will be. So we'll try to mediate and say, okay, if you need to get this tenant out, we need to give them some time, let them live for free there for 6-7 months. You know, again, it's not the ideal scenario because the owner really does have the right to evict the tenant. But often we can help avoid a costly court process and also make sure that the tenant isn't evicted overnight, you know.
And then you also do advocacy work with electeds and yes, with the city and with the agencies.
Yeah, I mean, we do advocacy on the city, state, and federal level on various housing issues, most of them related to those that affect our, you know, immigrant communities in the city. You know, it's pretty, issues of overcrowding, lead paint is a huge issue in this part of the city. We do a lot of advocacy around building up tenant rights as well. And more recently around the foreclosure crisis, we've been doing a lot of work around, you know, sort of making sure that the financial institutions comply with the Making Homes Affordable program, which they are not, you know.
And then tell me about, well, it seems like those two things sort of came together in the survey,
mm-hmm.
The work that you do
exactly
directly as well as the advocacy work. So tell me about how you conducted the survey and run through some key findings briefly.
Well, you know, when we were talking to HPD, the city's Housing Preservation and Development Unit, their first response to our request to look at this issue and potentially legalize these units was that they don't have actual documentation of their existence, which is crazy because they have a whole, you know, they have thousands of complaints filed, but they don't, they couldn't use that as actual documentation of the existence of the unit. So they said that's step one, is we need to document the fact that they actually exist. We need to get a sense of how many are there. So the goal of the survey was, one, to document that they even exist, and two, to see the feasibility of actually legalizing them. So look at issues of, you know, how many means of egress, how big the windows are, in case, like, you know, that could be used as a means of egress. So what we found was that we surveyed almost 450, I think, homes, and of them we found that I think 80% had some sign of use of a basement. And of that, we estimated 35% could potentially be legalized. And those were two census tracts we looked at. Actually, those highlighted there, one in Jackson Heights and one in Jamaica. We looked at those tracts specifically because there were single-family homes registered there. All the homes we surveyed were actually registered as single-family homes. And so that was the goal, was to look at what the actual data was versus what's on record. And so we partnered with CHPC. They helped us design the survey so that it would be easy to use a comparative analysis with the Housing and Vacancy Survey. But the challenge that we had is that we couldn't talk to a lot of tenants. The goal was really to talk to tenants and go inside the units and look at the physical conditions, but most tenants were afraid to let us in. So we ended up talking to, I think, probably like 15 tenants, but the rest were all owners that we spoke to, you know, who surprisingly were willing to talk about it, because they're all frustrated, you know, and would like to rent the units. You know, a lot of these areas, the areas that we looked at are also the same neighborhoods that have been impacted most by the foreclosure crisis. So these are also owners who are really struggling to make ends meet and need the rental income, you know.
So what would establishing an accessory dwelling unit code do? First, tell me what an accessory dwelling unit code
mm-hmm.
means,
mm-hmm.
and then tell me what you think it would do to address some of the issues that you're laying out.
So a lot of states have already implemented ADU codes. Really, the concept is that it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to change the zoning, although that would be ideal, but a lot of these areas are already zoned for higher density. But because they're single-family homes, converting to a two-family home is much more complicated. An accessory dwelling unit code is sort of getting around all of that so that it remains a single-family home with an accessory unit. So it sort of gets around a lot of the complicated, you know, zoning changes that would be needed and building code changes. The way, you know, in a lot of states like Washington, for example, Washington State, they created an ADU code, and the program was pretty aggressive and it was pretty innovative, where they passed legislation on the state level to create an ADU code and basically allowed local municipalities to create their own ADU plan so that, you know, the local cities could tailor it to what their needs were. But the state code, or the state legislation, mandated that each local municipality look at the issue and come up with a plan to create more density within those areas where it would fit. So that's generally the gist of it. I mean, a lot of the program really, we want to target it towards owner-occupied homes so that you don't end up with owners taking advantage of the situation and creating sort of housing that they don't necessarily care about maintaining the conditions of. Also, we want to ensure that owners have technical assistance, either provided by a nonprofit or a city agency. We feel a nonprofit would be more effective because we speak the languages and you know, we have the trust of the community. But also, there needs to be financial incentives. Right now, it costs about $10,000 to $15,000 is what the city estimated it would cost to actually legalize these, your average unit. And so that's a lot of money for your average homeowner to come up with. So you also need to create tax incentives and grant and loan programs.
So, I mean, when you say that it costs an average of that amount of money to legalize one of these units, does that mean there is a legal standard for these units existing?
Yes. I mean, we've been trying to help a few owners go through the process. So with the current building codes, it would be, you can actually do it. But only with basement apartments, right? So there's a cellar versus a basement. Cellar is more than 50% below ground, and basement is 50% above. 50% above. And so right now, that's part of what our argument is right now the codes are so strict that, you know, even if a unit is just a few inches off, you can't legalize it. So we've seen apartments that are more than 50% above ground in the front of the unit, but less in the back. And so they weren't able to legalize for that reason. So, you know, our argument is that these decisions should be based on health and safety, not necessarily on, you know, inches. You know, if there's enough air and light and it's safe, then it should be, you know, the codes should be more flexible.
Speaking of air and light, are there areas in which our housing code is outdated and runs contrary to the goal of developing affordable housing within the existing building stock?
Well, I'm sure there are many areas where it's outdated. I mean, I think some of the current pieces of legislation that are out there, there's an asthma bill that has to do with improving the conditions. But I can't speak right offhand of other codes, but I could share that.
You know. And how do you think the city should go about following your recommendations?
Well, I mean, you know, the ideal scenario would be to pass something on the state level as well as city level. But everyone's afraid of that. So what we're proposing to the city right now is that we start with a pilot project, ideally in these neighborhoods that we've already done some work in, where we would work with individual owners, you know, set a goal of maybe helping 100 owners go through the process so that the city can also learn from that process and also expedite them. You know, there was one owner that we helped in Sunset Park, and his apartment was good from the beginning. You know, the construction had been done well. They actually used the apartment, basement apartment, more than their first level apartment because it was more breezy. You know, the wife, she had asthma, and she preferred to spend her time downstairs because it was more habitable. But that case took us a year and a half, you know, even though no construction was needed. So the buildings department, you know, the processes also needs to be more streamlined, you know, so that's part of what we're trying to push them to do is they should create a separate department that's just focused on this and really work with owners on trying to ensure that it's done safely. You know. One of the challenges will be that a lot of these apartments already exist. So how do you ensure that they've been converted properly in terms of, you know, the wiring, the piping, that's all built in. So how do you, you know, a lot of architects are afraid to sign off on these apartments because they can't do a proper inspection of how the work was done. So that's a big challenge. You know.
Speaking of architects, in an ideal world, how would, into your mind, how would sort of the design community and architects be most helpful in terms of either redesigning the policies or creating things that are scalable in terms of redesigning the spaces themselves? In order to deliver more affordable housing in New York.
Right. Well, I think that is the actual missing piece for us right now. We have advocates, we have legal experts, but we don't have enough of the design community involved in the process. We need to stop it.
Yeah, hold on one sec.